On and off the field, women in sports are inspiring and motivating others to be the best versions of themselves, rewriting the rules and changing the game. This is the On Her Turf podcast, hosted by Katherine Tappan.
Welcome to the On Her Turf podcast. I'm Katherine Tappan. Thank you so much for joining us. Today we are joined in studio with Jill Gregory. Jill is the Senior Vice President and Chief Marketing Officer for NASCAR. In that role, Jill oversees the marketing department of NASCAR to include brand marketing, social media, and insights and analytics, among other functions. Jill, it's so great to have you here in person.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great that I could be in New York.
You are in New York, so let's talk about that. You travel a ton, but what brought you to New York City this time?
So this week, we had a Sports Business Journal, an industry publication, had a conference yesterday and today where they had all sorts of sports marketing executives, either on the brand side, the league side, just a place to talk about kind of the issues of the day and what's happening in the sports world. So some networking. And then I was on a panel earlier today with a couple of folks from MasterCard and Taco Bell. So just a lot of discussion about how sports is such an important marketing tool.
Well, it's interesting because I read the Sports Business Journal every single week and avidly. I mean, I love what's happening in our industry in every sport, even the ones that I don't cover. But for you, I mean, you get asked to be on so many different panels and you're in high demand. What makes, you know, being on that particular panel and with that brand so important to you?
Well, I think it's always important to give people that might not be as familiar with NASCAR a little peek inside of the curtain of what we do. You know, I think that there are a lot of folks out there that once they get to know what NASCAR is all about, either the drivers or the events or the competition, you know, they really are intrigued and really like it. But we have to spread that word a little bit. And this conferences like that give us an opportunity to do that.
So tell me a little, we'll get into the whole NASCAR side and what you're responsible for as far as helping the fans really understand what this great sport is all about. But how about you? How did you get into motorsports from the beginning?
Well, being from Northern California, it's not the most logical leap,
right,
for sure. So good point there. But I was always interested in sports. I'm one of three girls, and my dad, huge sports fan, San Francisco Giants fan, 49ers, so definitely that Northern California feel. So I was always involved in sports. And when I went to college in the Central California area at Cal Poly, but always wanted to figure out a way to make a career in sports, and worked in some agencies, and somehow, you know, relationships and you know this, networking and people you meet along the way kind of help you with your career. And the next thing I knew, I was working for Texaco on the sponsorship side, and obviously gas and oil, very involved in motorsports, and I got to know a lot of people there. So it really was a lot of networking and just whatever job you're in, do a great job, and then that next opportunity comes around.
Were you surprised when you went to your first NASCAR event at how much you enjoyed it? Or what was your initial reaction when you first went to the track? Because it can be overwhelming for some people and a big surprise.
It can. And I think that's part of what we have to do now that I'm in this role, is that, you know, let people know. You know what to expect if you're going to go to a football game, right? Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of mystery or how to do it or where to go. But for some of our first-time fans, it's can be daunting, like, you know, the size of the facility, what driver, you know, how to really enjoy it. So my first race, I grew up with a lot of male cousins that were race fans, and so I had a tour guide, if you will. But just the size and the scope, and, you know, you can get really close to the drivers and the cars. So it was intriguing to me when I went for the first time. And then as I have continued to make a career in it, I see each and every day kind of the access and the fan passion. These fans love it and love what we do. And so that kind of gives you the energy to keep doing it.
For me, my first NASCAR event was when I was working on regional network at NESN in Boston. And we had to cover up at Loudoun, yeah, one of the races up there. I was blown away by the sounds.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I was completely shocked at how loud it was, how energetic it was, how the fans were loud. I mean, that was unlike anything I had ever seen at a sporting event before. So you guys must feed on that in a way from a marketing and branding standpoint as well. How
engaged the fans are.
We do. And I think it's one of our key kind of our competitive advantage. I mean, those fans, they love what we do. They love the drivers. They want to know more about the backstories. And then at the event itself, it's just it's a totally immersive experience. You've got the headsets on or you're walking around with, you know, hundreds of thousands of other fans who might like a different driver, but they're all part of a community. And so there's just an energy at those at the races that it's hard to bottle up and show people that aren't there. And that's one of the challenges we have is like, how do we bring that to life for a fan that might not be able to get to the race?
I'm curious, you've mentioned accessibility quite a few times, and NASCAR drivers are notorious for being so accessible and so engaged with not only the media, but the fan base. And as you mentioned, people coming to the track for the first time. I cover the NHL as well, and we deal with a similar aspect as far as they are so genuine and they are accessible and they're there.
Right.
Certain sports sell themselves, like the NFL and Major League Baseball, and those athletes we're so familiar with because they're so publicized and a broad number of people are watching, to put an understatement. How do you get the personalities of these drivers? How do you try and get fans to really understand what they're like off the track to have them be more engaged and more focused on watching them on a weekly basis?
Yeah, it's a really good question. We have an entire group that's dedicated towards kind of helping the drivers. And I don't want to say it so formally to help build their brands because it doesn't sound authentic. Our drivers are already predisposed to interact with the fans and the sponsors because as they've kind of moved up the ranks, they've had to do that from the time they start racing at 6 or 7 years old or in their teens. There's always a sponsor involvement. There's always fans at the track that are very close to the action. So when they make it to that top level, they're used to that. And they think that's part of what their day job is. So, yes, you have to go drive the car and perform on the track. But the things that are kind of tangential to that, you have to be good with sponsors. You've got to take time to sign autographs. And I think as you move up the ranks in other stick and ball leagues, you don't have to do as much of that. So our drivers are kind of trained to do it. And then our group really tries to look at each driver as their own personality and figure out what's going to be intriguing or interesting about this driver. Is it their background? Is it how they made it? What their motivation is? So that storytelling is hugely important for us as we expose all of these different drivers to new fans and then some of our core fans as well.
Well, I love as well the social media platforms that many of them are on, and you get such a glimpse into their personal life. I mean, I'll talk about just Dale Jr. from our perspective at NBC Sports. He comes on and he is incredible not only to work with. I had the opportunity to work with him at the Super Bowl, but just getting to know him on a personal level, and he's one of the greatest in the sport of all time and comes from a legendary family as well. When you look at someone like Dale Jr. and the transition that he's made from the track to the TV side of broadcasting, you know, what does that give you as far as a vision of what might also be coming down the pipe for some of the other drivers that are looking at retirement and post-racing careers?
Yeah, I think what Dale has done has been almost a case study in how to make that transition from the competition side of things to your retirement. And I actually had the opportunity to go to his charity event last week in Charlotte. And he made a joke that he's busier and his schedule is more packed now than it was when he was driving because, you know, he's like, at least when I was driving, you know, I could say I had to be in the car. And that was a time that people, you know, knew I was busy. And so he's just wrote a book and is in the booth, obviously, with NBC and has done a fantastic job. So I think what he's shown is that, you know, there are a lot of different touch points that a driver can have even after they're out of the race car. And obviously fans love him. He's obviously our most popular driver for many years running. But his love of the sport and just his desire to still be involved, it comes across in the broadcast. And you said you worked with him at Super Bowl. I mean, he just wants to share his enthusiasm. So I think that makes the fans get all excited.
And he wants to be a part of a team, too. I mean, I think he really enjoys being a part of an NBC Sports team. Right. You know, NASCAR is an individual sport, but they are part of this greater team with their sponsorships and with their fellow drivers within that team. So how much of a challenge is that as far as what you do in marketing and trying to, you know, promote the sport with the fact that they are individual drivers, but they're part of a bigger picture of a team as well?
Yeah, it's an interesting balance because obviously the drivers are first and foremost. You know, that's the visible, you know, the most visible piece of a team. But it's the crew chief, the preparation, all of the engineering that goes into it. And I think, you know, when we talk about storytelling, it can come from any area. Most people think of the drivers and what's their backstory, but there are thousands of stories along pit road each and every week. And so we want to uncover all of those, because something that, you know, we might not think is that compelling to a fan might be really interested in knowing about how a guy became a tire changer for a race team. So, you know, obviously the drivers are where we spend a lot of our time, but we're looking for stories, and digital and social, our channels allow us a really great platform to share more of those stories.
Well, you talk about the pit crews, and I've got to ask you, because I know a lot of people, when we were telling our team for On Her Turf that you were coming in, one of the questions I got from one of the members of our team was, you know, ask her about the diversity of the women on the pit crew and ask her what that's all about and where we're going with that. So is there a female presence in these pit crews, and what is it if there is?
There really is. And I think one of the things that is unique about our sport is that men and women compete on the same field of play. So you look at Danica Patrick, she wasn't racing in the NASCAR Women's League. She was racing on, on the track with our top drivers. We've got women up and down Pitt Road in the role of kind of chief engineer. We've got Brianna Daniels, who's an African-American pit crew member on the Monster Energy NASCAR Cup Series tour, and she's got an amazing story. So she's a former college basketball player. So if you've got the talent, the athleticism, the engineering degree, I mean, you can compete on the same field of play with anybody out there. So I think that's something that, you know, we'll continue to pull those stories out. But the more role models there are for you to look up to, then you say, oh, wow, I can do that. So we want to see as many women in those positions as we can.
Yeah, that's so cool. I didn't even think that, you know, I mean, the engineering degree and then the athletic background and someone like Brianna, is it's a great transition for her. And she's part of this great atmosphere as well, like when she was competing. Seems like a no-brainer, a good fit for her. When you mentioned Danica Patrick, and, you know, I'm curious what the impact was of Danica while she was competing, and has there been a void since she retired from the sport that you feel you might need to find to fill?
You know, it's a good question. I think, you know, Danica was a huge addition to our sport. She obviously created a buzz. She had has a huge brand. And she was toe-to-toe with the top drivers in our sport and didn't back down. I don't know if you've interacted with her, but anybody that has is like, she's tough. And she's, you know, there to prove herself not as the best female driver, but was always out there wanting to be the best driver. So, you know, the success on the track maybe wasn't what she wanted, and I think she would say that. But for us to have her in such a highly visible position in our top series was huge. But as, you know, cycles go through different sports, you see drivers retire, drivers come in, and that was part of kind of the natural transition. And it's up to us as NASCAR, as drivers, whether it's Danica Patrick or Dale, as they retire and take on different roles in their lives, hopefully in the sport or maybe not, who are the next drivers that are going to fill that pipeline? And how do we expose those young drivers to more fans and get them to be as excited about these new drivers as they were about the ones that have recently left?
Well, part of engaging those fans and part of your job description, I know, is, you know, this next generation of NASCAR fans, sports fans, they're constantly engaged on their mobile devices and social media platforms. And some of the challenges in engaging those fans is deciding which social media platforms are more effective, right? There's so many. There's Instagram, there's Twitter. There's, I mean, more than I even know, and I feel like a fossil being a part of the social media world. But what do you do with regards to how you determine which platforms are more significant than others, how you want to engage certain fans on Facebook versus Twitter? I mean, what is the general philosophy that you adhere to with that?
Yeah, so we kind of feel like in this world of like constant communication and constant, you know, stimulation and short attention span that, you know, if we're not in every place where a fan might want to find us, then we're missing an opportunity. So we need to be on 24/7, not just when the race is going on, which is just, you know, one period during a weekend, but 24/7, and be, you know, if a NASCAR fan wants his fix of NASCAR, then, and he's on Twitter, then we need to have content on Twitter. If he's a Facebook user, then we need to have content there. If we want to attract a new fan, we have a partnership with Snapchat, and we're actually going to do a program with them in Miami. And that allows us to get access to a younger fan who might not know anything about what NASCAR is all about. And it's less about the racing than it is about the experience. And so we've got all of these drivers or folks at the track capturing their experience and sharing it on the Snapchat story. So it just gives a view of something and piques the interest of a fan that's younger and, you know, using social media that might not ordinarily try us. So we have to be everywhere all the time, and that's why our content group is so important.
Yeah, it's not just social media either. When you talk about the experiences, I know just the Sports Business Journal every week talks about a certain stadium or a certain experience, and the way football stadiums, soccer stadiums, baseball stadiums are really modifying their fan experience, and they're becoming more mobile, they're becoming more interactive. Even something as simple as concessions, nobody even wants to get up and get a hot dog anymore. They want it to come to them. I mean, this, like, it's just crazy where we're headed, but it is where we're headed. It's the reality of it. So how do you also use your social media stimulation with the fan groups in the stadiums as well, in the arena, at the racetrack?
Well, you know, you hit it on the head. It's this instant gratification.
Yeah.
I want everything when I want it, at the time I want it, and that's the in-arena or in-venue experience too. So, you know, you've got to have Wi-Fi connectivity. You've got to have all the bells and whistles. And I think the interesting development for us has been, in talking to some of the folks at the conference earlier, it's not about the game, the tournament, the race. It's all of the other things, the social interaction with your friends, what the right concession is, the entertainment that's going on around you. So it's less about the action on the track or on the field. It's about all of the other stimulation that a fan might want. So every venue operator, every league is having to look at what are the fan demands at the time and then try to meet those and anticipate them.
Do you hear from the athletes with regards to that? Do you hear from the drivers as far as, you know, all of this is happening around us, that the fans are less interested perhaps sometimes in what we're doing on the track and they're more concerned with, you know, Snapchatting with their friends that they're here at this NASCAR event?
You know, I think they're probably insulated from that piece of it a little bit. You know, they still see there's a throng of people around their car when they're getting ready mm-hmm. to go race the Daytona 500, and they can hardly get close to the car because there's so many fans. So I think they still see a lot of fan interaction, but they're users of social media themselves, and they're also, most of our drivers are avid sports fans in other sports, so they know what they want at a venue. So I think they understand what we have to do to stay competitive.
Well, you mentioned earlier talking about role models and how significant they are. And I'm curious to know who your role models have been throughout not only your career, but early in your life and, you know, eventually getting into this wonderful sport that you were with. But who are your role models?
Well, you know, it's like a lot of people talk about mentoring doing a better job of mentoring. And I found, and you may feel the same way, is that, you know, there wasn't always just one person that you could look up to and like help you shepherd your career. It can come, mentoring or support can come from many different areas. But I think it started with the work ethic and mm-hmm. like the persistence and just working harder and trying to outwork everybody else. And that comes from my parents. So a really close-knit family growing up, sports was a big part of it. A lot of competition, but in a way of like learning practice and commitment and do what you say you're going to do. And, you know, if you signed up for it, you're not quitting until it's
sure.
over.
Sure. Oh, yes. I've heard that one before.
Yeah. So a lot of us that either played sports, and I was obviously never close to being competitive, but that was just ingrained in you have practice, you've got winners and losers. You just kind of learn, or at least I did, from my family environment. And I think a lot of those lessons, I didn't know they were lessons at the time, have kind of served me well as I've tried to move up and do a good job in my career. And I think I've been also lucky to have a couple of key folks along the way that I could look up to, whether they knew they were mentors to me or not. They led by example, and that's been helpful. But I think part of what is important to me now is that as there are more and more female leaders and employees at NASCAR, is providing more support to them than maybe I had coming up along the ranks, because there are more and more females. We're not close to being there yet, if you will, but I think there are more role models for someone coming up now. And I think that we do a lot at NASCAR to try to provide a sense of community and support for our female employees, just because we know that, you know, a more diverse and kind of engaged employee base is going to make us better from a business standpoint.
Yeah, amen. I love that. So, you know, in your role as Senior VP and Chief Marketing Officer, you are a leader, and you're a leader of a very, very large group of men and women. What is your leadership style, would you say?
You know, I think I've had to evolve it over time. You know, it used to be very, some of my folks on my team would say, you know, a little anal about details and being involved in every project. And, you know, as you continue to take on more responsibility, it's hard to give some of that stuff up, and you want everything to be done and done perfectly and done in a great way. And you have to let some of that go. And so I think that one of the things I've really tried hard to do is just to let my team do their job, even if it's not exactly the way I would have done it.
Right.
You kind of let them do it. And then, you know, if you've got an issue or a problem, you solve it, you move on. And that's the other thing. I'm a big believer in, you know, bad news doesn't get any better the longer it sits. So if we've got a challenge, an issue, something we need to handle, hit it head on right away, solve it, and move on, and don't dwell on it. But that's after, you know, several different stints and in different roles in sports. But I think it's the same in any business.
Would you describe yourself personally as being that way, too? I mean, it must be hard to relinquish a responsibility and to entrust, you know, your team to do things that you like to do. You're way of the highway, and I get that. I'm very similar. But personally, what are you like, would you say?
I'm pretty organized and like things, you know, a certain way. But I think you also have to kind of let things go sometimes. And that comes with maturity. I think you just, you know, understand what you can control and have to be a little bit more forgiving about things that you can't. But I think anybody that kind of is successful and has moved up in different leadership roles has to have some structure, you know, unless you're, you know, a creative person, which I didn't have that gene, unfortunately. you know, my strengths are more in the organization and the process, but it served me well. And then giving my people and our team a chance to succeed and grow together has been hugely important. You know, we have a long season. You know, sports is a demanding business. So you have to love what you do and who you do it with, or, you know, it's going to be a quick burnout.
Yeah, you become almost a family with everybody that you work with because of the hours and the weekends and the holidays that you spend together. You mentioned that you had two other sisters, so you're one of three. So were you competitive growing up?
A little bit, yeah. You know, we played tennis, was our sport. When all three of us played tennis, but just not competitive to an extent that, you know, we're like our drivers racing each other to see who gets to the car first. but I think we had a good, you know, a good understanding of just competing and what that meant and kind of the discipline that was associated with doing something, trying to do it well.
Take me into a boardroom, and when you're in there with mostly men most of the time, what is your go-to motto as far as how you conduct yourself and how you get the proper message conveyed that you want to achieve at that given time, given point in time?
You know, I think be prepared. You know, if you are prepared, you know what you want to say, you know what your point of view is or your argument, you've got the facts to back it up. Try to take the emotion out of it. We were, part of the conference was 7 o'clock this morning, was a women's breakfast. And, you know, a lot of young women asking somewhat of the same question. And somebody said something that really resonated is like, you know, don't take things personal. And I think, you know, when you're in the boardroom and the decision gets made or debate is happening, you have to take the emotion out of it and not take it personally, which is easier said than done sometimes. But I think if you've got the facts and the point of view and you're confident in your position, you have to go for it and push yourself to go for it, even if it's a little bit out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, I'm the worst with that. I'm very emotional and I take everything personally. But, you know, I have learned over time, you do have to take, I have to take a step back and I have to not let the emotion get the best of me. And I'm sure, you know, I would have loved to be a part of that breakfast because it sounds like other women or other females in similar positions deal with the same kind of things. I mean, you're passionate about what you believe in. It's hard to keep your mouth shut. It's hard to not want to speak up and fight back, but you do have to take a moment sometimes. I'm sure that happens with you as well, where you're making big decisions and you have to maybe take 24 hours and sleep on it or leave the boardroom for a moment and really think about what you have to achieve here.
Or don't send that email that you really want to send. And it's interesting because you don't want to take, I think part of that emotion is what makes women good leaders, right? Because you've got, you know, empathy or you're trying to understand the other person's point of view. And I think any good leader does that, but you don't want to take away the things that might help you make better decisions, but you also sometimes just have to hold it all in and just be very dispassionate about it. Once you get your point across or you win the negotiation, then I think you can bring more of your style back in. Yeah. So it's fun.
You were chatting earlier. I know we were talking before we got on the microphones here for the podcast about the travel and how great it is. You get to see wonderful parts of the country and the world. You get to make it back home to the Bay Area where, you know, you call Charlotte home now. So it's not every day you get to get back there. But there's also very big challenges that come with the travel and the demands of the job. What are some of the biggest challenges that you've had and experienced throughout your career, that and how did you find ways to overcome those obstacles, whether it was not being a part of family events that you wanted to be a part of because you had a humongous Daytona 500 that you had to be a part of? Tell me about those challenges.
Yeah, it's, you know, it does seem glamorous, and I'm sure you see it a lot. You know, you touch a ton of different sports as well. And, you know, this idea that, you know, we jet off and do all these great things, you know, there's a reality to that, right? That work-life balance. And I think one of the biggest challenges I see is that a season for us is February through November. So Valentine's Day to Thanksgiving, to put that in perspective. And you become very calendar driven. Mm-hmm. And like, then you look at October 31st and you're like, wow, a whole year has gone by and I didn't get together with my college roommate like we were going to, or I missed the 70th birthday party for my aunt that I wanted to go to.
Right.
And you, as the course of a year is going on, you think, okay, that's one off. That's too bad. I didn't do that. But then you look back and you're thinking, there's too many of those things that I'm missing. And so that's hard. I try to be mindful in a given year or things that I want to do, but it's hard to, when you get into the day to day of your responsibilities, those things that seem small and one little miss here tend to add up, and you kind of really have to examine that. At least I try to each year and try to do a better job, but it's hard to balance
right.
all of that.
Yeah, you mentioned it there, the word balance, and everybody has a different definition on right. what balance is. What is your definition, and is it achievable, do you think?
You know, I think that part of when you get to a leadership role like this, you're wired this way to be, you know, not an overachiever, but you want to be, you know, competent, and you're driven by that. And so there's some satisfaction in that, because that's the way,
sure.
That's what's gotten you here. But, you know, I think that you have to define your own balance. And to me, you know, I think for a lot of people, it's not a year. It's like, hey, this weekend, did I do what I needed to do for a friend of mine? Mm-hmm. Am I being a good sister? Am I being a good, you know, friend? And you kind of just have to take them as they come. And you do have to take time for yourself. There was a guy that was talking about meditation yesterday in the conference. And I think there was a collective eye roll, like, well, who's got time to do
yeah.
that?
And how do you do that? Right. I have a hard time meditating.
Right. And so you're like, yes, yeah, it's like 10 minutes every day. You need to go try this. And I'm thinking all these people in the room are like, I'm never doing that.
Right.
But whatever way works for you, if it's exercise or being with friends or family, I have nieces and nephews that I try to spend time with too. So you kind of have to take it where you can. But knowing that, you know, what you do in your professional life is a big part of who you are, too. So I don't think there's any right or wrong answer on the number or the balance, you know, what the ratio is. It's just got to work for you.
I read something interesting that you mentioned in a 2014 Marie Claire interview regarding networking. And you touched on networking early on in the podcast, but you had a quote that said, I don't have time to network. I'm always on the road. And I think it's about your work, your style and your word and whether people enjoy working with you. So you try to maintain those relationships and let your work speak for itself. This really resonated with me because when I go back and speak to universities or my college or my places I've been in the past, I always talk about the importance from a young age early in your career to get the network going, right? You are clearly at a different point in your career. So is that kind of what you were referencing in that article, that maybe it's not always attainable to network all the time because you're so busy?
Yeah, and I think that I wish I had done more of that. You know, I look back in things that you wish you would have done better, and whether it's because you're working so hard because you're trying to prove yourself or you're taking on the extra project. But I think, you know, the more I've learned, and actually the more women in sports I've gotten to know, I'm like, wow, I really wish I would have known her earlier in my career. That would have been a great sounding board or a good relationship to have. So I think I would have put more importance on it than I did when I was younger, because it may have helped, or it may have just made it feel like you're not kind of on your own in trying to exactly. do what you're doing.
Interesting. Okay, we talked about female influences in NASCAR, and I've got to ask you about Haley Deegan, 17 years old. She made NASCAR history in September, becoming the first woman since 1989 to win a race. She then followed that up at the end of October, becoming the first woman to win Rookie of the Year honors in any NASCAR series, following her sixth place finish at the K&N West Series season final. What does this mean to the sport, having someone like Haley, who is so accomplished at 17 years old?
Well, and she's an amazing person. She's super outgoing. She's very active in digital and social. She loves racing. And, you know, her background, she comes from a racing family. Mm-hmm. But she's the total package because she loves what she does. And, you know, we talk about authenticity. And that this is a 17-year-old who can sit in an interview like this and be completely polished. But also awesome. Her love for racing and that she's 17 comes through because, you know, she's 17. So I think the package of, you know, success on the track and her skill and her talent combined with her off the track activities and her willingness to engage and show herself and show her personality, it's huge for us. I mean, we need drivers that are engaging to fans across all of our different series, male, female. But she's got, you know, the ability on the track and this kind of that quality that, you know, you see as you come across mm-hmm. athletes, that intangible that it's hard to put a name on. But she's got charisma, she's good, and she has the desire. Like, she wants to be the best, and not just on the track, but in her, you know, social media or her personality. So we've got a really good prospect there, and we're pretty excited.
Yeah, I can see you just sitting here with you. You're chomping at the bit. I mean, you probably have an abundance of ideas of where to go with her, but such an incredible accomplishment that she achieved. And I'm excited to see what she can do going forward. The sky is certainly the limit for her, and it's fun to see her personality as well. She's a great, great person, and you know her personally. Well, I know you have a flight to catch, and
I do.
We have just a few more questions I like to get totally off the cuff to kind of get an idea, a little glimpse into Jill Gregory. But what is your guilty pleasure?
Oh, my guilty pleasure. Probably going to concerts, live music.
Oh, fun. Mm-hmm. Any music genre in particular you like?
Well, a little known fact, it won't be little known now, big 90s hip hop fan,
oh,
which
yes,
the people on my team are like, what? I'm like, yeah,
I think
sorry.
We were separated at birth. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, so love that. And I'll do a little classic too. My high school friends and I went and saw Journey in San Francisco a couple
Very
weeks
cool.
ago. So that was kind of a good, like, you know, check off the box kind of thing. But love music. And it's if I didn't have that to listen to when I'm traveling, then I'd probably go crazy.
So 90s hip hop, is that like on your workout mix? And mm-hmm. your yeah.
Oh, yeah. My Spotify, awesome. My Pandora, yes. they're like, you need to download Tupac Radio.
A little I'm Tupac, like, LL Cool J. Oh, oh, that's the best. Yeah. I love it. Okay, cool. I could end the interview. I could have started and ended the interview right there. Yeah. What is one item besides your cell phone that you cannot leave your house without?
I would say my headphones for listening to music.
You get the AirPods or you have the long... Okay, perfect. What's the one item on your bucket list right now?
You know, I would like to go to... I've never been to Australia. I'd like to travel more. And we talked about travel before, but, you know, travel for work and travel for pleasure are two different things. So I'd like to get either over to Australia, to Bali or somewhere just away from kind of unplug for a little bit.
Very cool. Well, we have to unplug with you. I know it's been fun, Jill, but we look forward to seeing all your continued success. And thanks so much for taking the time to come here in studio to join us. It's been a pleasure.
It's been great. Thank you for having me.
A huge thank you to Jill Gregory, the Senior Vice President and Chief Marketing Officer for NASCAR. And be sure to catch all the excitement of the NASCAR Miami race on Sunday, November 18th at 3 p.m. Eastern, only on NBC. You can also download the On Her Turf podcast on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. Let us know what you think. We certainly want to hear from you, so be sure to chime in. You can also follow us on Instagram at On Her Turf. Have a great rest of your day, and be sure to join us next time for the On Her Turf podcast.